the border. We had no power. I think we've a bit of power now.
Our mission was to show that we're no longer the whipping boys of Munster.
Four All-Ireland senior football title wins, eight in Leinster, three national leagues, and for good measure, the Centenary Cup in the only year where that was staged back in 1984. I think that honours list captures just how amazing and successful the Sean Boylan era in Meath football was, the manager for all of 23 years of the county senior football side. So that's the topic we're going to explore this week on Warriors, the GA podcast for you, the 42 members. Hello and welcome along. I'm Fintan O'Toole. This week sees RTE air the documentary Sean, which looks at the life and times of the Meath football legend. And we're going to chat today to Alan Bradley, the director and producer of the documentary. There's some great contributions in this from Sean, his family, and a whole host of Meath players, the likes of David Beggy, Joe Castles, Mick Lyons, Jerry McEntee, Colm O'Rourke, Brian Stafford, Cullum Coyle, Tommy Dowd, Trevor Giles, Darren Fay, Graham Geraghty. It's really who's who of Meath football and the stars that guided the county to All-Ireland wins in 1987, 1988, 1986 and 1989. They contested another three All-Ireland finals. And when you think that Meath as a county have lifted the Sam Maguire on seven occasions and Sean Boylan was the manager for four of them, I think it really sums up the kind of place he occupies in the county's GA history. It's 15 years this month since he retired as Meath senior football boss, having initially only taken up the job on, I guess, what was perceived as a stopgap basis back in 1982, but it proved to be a hugely successful time. So we're going to chat to Alan about the background of the documentary, Sean's incredible longevity, just how he was so successful as Meath manager and the bond he had with those players. But there's loads of other stuff as well to get into away from football. There was his life working as a herbalist. There's his family, you know, his dad was involved in the IRB. And there's just so much to kind of get through and kind of really, I suppose, look at the character and the legend that is Sean Boylan. So let's get right to it. Here's our chat with Alan Bradley and a closer look at the Meath football icon, Sean Boylan, in episode 18 of Warriors. So did he take much persuading? I mean, he's a very, you know, I've only met him a few times in kind of various media dealings, but he's a very open and kind of warm character. But, you know, it's still a big thing to I suppose, allow someone to kind of shine a spotlight on you like this, because, you know, there's so much to him. It's not just the Meath football manager that patrolled the sidelines. You know, there's his family background with his parents. There's his family now. There's what he works as with a herbalist. You know, there are a lot of layers to him, and the documentary explores all of them. So how, I suppose, enthusiastic and willing was he to get on board with the project?
Yeah, so I suppose I wouldn't be an obvious candidate to make the film because I am from Cavan. I'm not a Meath man. But my dad's from Meath, and I kind of grew up with the real understanding of who Sean was, and sort of I remember the 96 and 99 All-Irelands and the celebrations and the excitement of it all as a kid. So I was aware of him, and then just over the years seeing him on TV or speaking, and I just kind of found him a fascinating character, more so of outside of football, just as a person. So I kind of got drawn to him in that sense. And then I had made a previous shorter documentary. So I was looking at doing a feature, and I thought he is someone who is so fascinating. I'd love to do it on him. And then I just reached out to him and kind of had help from Andy McEntee just to get in touch, which was really great. And I don't know why Sean agreed to do it with me or why he said yes. I'm very grateful that he did. And then we just went from there.
So did he take much persuading? I mean, he's a very, you know, I've only met him a few times in kind of various media dealings, but he's a very open and kind of warm character. But, you know, it's still a big thing to I suppose, allow someone to kind of shine a spotlight on you like this, because, you know, there's so much to him. It's not just the Meath football manager that patrolled the sidelines. You know, there's his family background with his parents. There's his family now. There's what he works as with a herbalist. You know, there are a lot of layers to him, and the documentary explores all of them. So how, I suppose, enthusiastic and willing was he to get on board with the project?
Yeah, like I was kind of amazed, to be honest, and still am, at how on board he was. He was really on board, really positive from the get go. Like I just had a chat with him about why I wanted to do it, and then that was kind of it. We were away. And what was really great for me, especially as a young filmmaker and a kind of relatively new one, Sean was very open from the get go. Never said what we could talk about or couldn't talk about. Never even asked why I was asking questions or what angle I was going. Like, for the 2 years, I don't think Sean had an idea as to what I was making. Like, he never asked. He kind of just trusted me to go and do it, which I think is rare. I think even if someone was making a documentary about me, I think I definitely would want to know more about what they were doing. But no, he was very, very trusting and open, and you know, nothing was anything we couldn't talk about. And I'm really, really grateful for that, because it makes it kind of easier for me then to, you know, delve deep, which is what I wanted to try and do.
Can you give us an insight into the process then? Because you've touched on it there. Look, a lot of people flick on the TV on Thursday night. They watch a documentary, Sean Boylan. They really enjoy it. You know, it's an hour long. But like you've said, they're two years in the making. So, you know, can you maybe give us a bit of a background as regards how do you actually kind of go about it once you've got him on board and kind of what it all entails?
Oh, yeah. No, there's a lot of work. Yeah, like I think we did, I'm not sure exactly, but I'd say we did definitely 7 filming days with Sean himself. And they're sit-down interviews, you know, they could go on for a few hours. So, you know, you end up with hours and hours and hours of content, because we obviously interviewed as well, you know, former players, Colm O'Rourke, Graham Geraghty, these kind of people, and Sean's friend, Bruce Shields, some of his family members. So we've got all these hours of interviews, and then you have to try and distill it all down into kind of a story that makes sense. I spent 17 hours watching Meath football matches back to back, which was quite an experience.
was that penance for a Cavan man to be looking at successful days from your neighbours?
I think it was. To be honest, I thought it was going to be a horrendous task, but in ways I actually really enjoyed it, because it's different when you're looking at it from through the lens I was, where you're trying to get nuggets of gold, kind of, or a commentator might say something brilliant. So it was actually less of a kind of horrendous experience than I thought it would be.
The longevity of him, I suppose, maybe to just focus on the Gaelic football for a part of it, it's really quite incredible, I think, to, you know, you kind of see sports, various sports now, how, you know, the managers kind of maybe have a short shelf life, and that's been kind of shown more in the GAA. I mean, I guess Brian Cody and Mickey Hart are the two current ones, but for him to kind of last 23 years, having done the documentary and worked with him, do you now kind of understand, maybe more than most people, why he was able to kind of keep going in such a demanding and challenging job for so long?
Oh yeah, for sure. And I can see why he was kept for so long, 100%, because before I did wonder, I was like, how did he manage to keep, because it's a fickle thing. So, but he did, and times maybe when they weren't winning, he still was kept on. And I think if you spend any time with him, he's just extremely inspiring, and he fills you with just a self-belief. Even me, myself, I've left my interviews with him, you know, walking on a cloud. So I could see how the players would feel that. And it's not something you'd want to lose. And I think it's rare. So I do, yeah, I think that's the crux of what, in my opinion, why he stood the test of time and stayed there for so long.
We'll maybe go into the impact he had on the players in a minute, but I think it's almost kind of funny to look at the scene, the reaction when he started, first of all. And there was one with the David Beggy kind of turns to Joe Castles and said, did you think he'd do it? And Joe Castles is like, and there's just kind of silence, you know. So I like, the players are fairly shut up about it. Like, I mean, he was a complete unknown figure. He was definitely someone from left field. And you might kind of take us through that. Like, you know, this was a bit of a surprise appointment. And like, no one could have had any idea or envisaged what he was going to do when he took the job back in 1982.
Yeah, even himself, I do think it's really funny to look back, because you see him now as such a success story. But back then, he had no intention of being a football manager. He was actually more passionate about hurling, really. And actually thought when he got the call about the job that it was for the hurling job. So it wasn't on his radar at all. And he was very vaguely involved with the team, kind of coming in and giving lads kind of massages and things as a amateur physio almost. Like, that was it. A lot of the team wouldn't have even known him. And he just thought he'd do it for a while till they got someone. Didn't think he had the qualifications or credentials to do the job at all. and it just kind of snowballed, really.
I think he says that, doesn't it? That, well, I think, was it Eamon Farrell is the name of his neighbor who says to him, you should have a go at it until they get someone else. So, I mean, he must be the greatest stopgap manager of all time if we're going on that.
Yeah, he did a good long stint at it. Yeah, he gave them plenty of time.
It wasn't plain sailing for him, though. I mean, he kind of talks about that. Like, I think Colin O'Rourke kind of pinpoints 1985 as the revolutionary change in giving him complete control and picking his selectors. And I felt that team change kind of shone through in it, because so there's the change in, I suppose, the power that he's given by the management. And then there's the stuff that he does throughout his time. I mean, the stuff about the training sessions is really, really great. Like, I mean, I think it's called aqua jogging now, I guess is what you call it, like, you know. But like, for the players, they were saying at this time in the early 90s when this was being done, before the 1991 season, I mean, this was completely alien. And the players are kind of upfront talking about that, but then now they look back and they just see how innovative he was. And I guess that's another big quality which kind of helped him to sustain at the top for so long.
Yeah, 100%. I think Sean was way ahead of his time. He had all these training techniques, like bringing them to Gormanstown for the aqua kind of training. But it seemed so crazy to them at the time because they're in a pool, nothing to do with being on a pitch, kicking a ball. But there was so much behind it for Sean because they were getting older. They had all these injuries. It made sense to train in water because there wasn't all this weight on your joints, and it really helped them. You know, there's always so much more to it. Even he brought them to the sea. Or they would train on the dunes, the sand dunes in Bettystown Beach, which was tough going. And then he would get them all to get into the sea afterwards, which they thought was nuts. But Sean would be talking about the healing properties in the water. And like that time of year, there's magnesium. I don't even know what's in the water, but all these things he has. And, you know, there's always something behind it. So he was very invested and always thinking outside the box. But yeah, I think also part of it is the psychology and the sports psychology. He was way ahead of his time in kind of getting the players' mindsets right, and sort of he brought them to the Hill of Tara a lot, and that's in the film too. And there's a lot more about the Hill of Tara than just the fact it was a big hill to run up and down. You know, he very much drove it home to them that this was kind of almost like Meade's ancestral home, like the High Kings of Ireland, their throne. And sort of instilling that confidence in them that they did say, like, it's funny, like, they kind of took it as almost like, oh, what's he going on about now? But in another way, it really sank in with them too. So he kind of managed to juggle all of that in a way that I think was very effective.
Yeah, that's a really lovely scene. I think it's a kind of an aerial shot of the Hill of Tara, and he's narrating over it, and then it cuts back to him, and he just says, it's a sacred place. And I thought that kind of cut to, you know, got the impression, maybe not knowing the background to it too well, to be honest, beforehand, that there was a lot of kind of club rivalry, kind of getting guys to band together for the county was an issue. And I think Colin Rourke kind of touches on it. That was one of his great gifts, that when they all got into that dressing room, not only did he bring them together as a Meade squad, but I suppose going what you're saying about the sports psychology stuff, he really kind of imbued this sense of, you know, we're all in this for Meade and the kind of history and tradition of the place, which that's not an easy thing to do. Like, I mean, not a lot of managers are successful in managing to achieve that.
No, particularly at the beginning when Sean took over, the county team wasn't really doing a whole lot. So players were far more focused on the club championship, and the rivalries were fierce. So they weren't that invested in playing as a county team. The rivalries ran too deep because club football was so important. And Sean kind of noticed that and noticed it was an issue. And from the get-go kind of said, you can have all your rivalries during the week, but when you come in to train with me, we're all playing together and we're all Meade men. And that, I think, was probably crucial to their success.
To get the players on board, I mean, I was thinking about it. If to draw a modern comparison, Brian Cody is a very kind of a tall, imposing figure. He has done it with Kilkenny as a player. He has won the All-Ireland medals. You know, I think you talk about it in the documentary that, you know, Meade played at a very physically demanding, shall we say, time of football. Dirty is the way a good few of them were described, of course, over the years. But I mean, like, you know, he's a small man in stature, doesn't seem to have that very imposing, but just, yeah, he just got these players on board, and, you know, he had them in the palm of his hand, it seems, you know, from almost the very start.
Yep, he did. And I think that's just his way. That's his real talent. Through everything that he does, through his herbalism, through all his dealings in life, is just his ability to connect with people where they're at. I think it's David Begge talks about how he was able to juggle the characters. So certain people maybe needed their confidence built. Some people maybe didn't. They might have needed the opposite. So he was able to meet people where they were at. And he sort of has this ability to get you when he meets you. And he gets at you and knows what you need. And he's able to bring that out of you then. So yeah, that's probably the crux of really everything he does, I would say.
Just to look at his background, you might take us through that. The story of his father and his kind of role in Irish life is pretty fascinating.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. Sean's dad was the general of the East Division of the IRB and was very involved in sort of the fight for Irish freedom. And that kind of played a role in Sean's upbringing, obviously, because it was a huge part of their history and they're very aware of it. And also people will be calling to the house to get pensions over the years and things like that. So he would have been very, very aware of it. And Sean had a very close relationship with his dad. You know, he absolutely idolized him. And I think he says in the film, his father had a lot more faith in him than he had in himself, because that's almost the interesting thing about Sean, really, is that as a young person, particularly, he didn't have actually that much self-confidence in him at all. And that sort of developed over time. But it was the confidence his father had in him that kind of allowed him to push himself forward, which is interesting because that's what Sean's done for so many other people. Because I think he kind of stepped into a father figure role with particularly the 90s team, Meath team. And he kind of almost came full circle with that role that his father had. You know, he became a leader like his father did, just in a different way, and inspired other people.
And it's all over, and Meath are the All-Ireland football champions for 1999. They took their chances. John McDermott delighted. The Meath fans really savouring the moment. So Joe McDonagh, GAA president, presents Sam Maguire to Graham Geraghty, and Meath are the football champions. Liam McCarthy will spend the year in Cork, but Sam goes down the road to the Royal County. It's been a great last 15 years really for Meath. Sean Boylan at the helm throughout all those years, and another success.
Hip hip! Hip hip! Hip hip! Hip, hip.
Yeah, that's kind of amazing to think, because he just comes across as a guy you think, right, well, this he must have been a confident kid and he kind of always had that, but it seems like it's completely the opposite. It kind of grew over time, and he credits his dad for a lot of that. And like his relationship with his mother then, it kind of seems that he cared for her a lot, and you definitely get the sense that he reflects very fondly on his parents and his time with them.
Oh, for sure, yeah, because Sean's mum kind of had an accident when Sean was, I'd say, he's in his 30s maybe, and he spent a lot of time kind of caring for her and kind of, he was very, very involved with them kind of all through adulthood, and they played a huge role in his life, both of them. And even to this day, when he talks about them, it's still very fondly remembered, and kind of, you know, they don't seem so distant when he talks about them even now.
His life strikes me as one that kind of went on different paths than what he had expected. So getting the Meath job, didn't think that was going to happen. Becoming a herbalist, you might talk about that. That wasn't exactly the career path he thought he had chosen for himself. And he also says he didn't think he was going to get married. And it was kind of just maybe after his mother passed away, I think, was he at home one Christmas? And then suddenly it kind of dawned on him. The routes maybe that he thought life had mapped out for him, it kind of went off in different directions.
Yeah, he's a great example of going with the flow. What he has ended up doing is not what he thought he would. He didn't think he'd be a herbalist. I think that might have been a confidence thing too. I think he thought he wouldn't be able to be as great as his dad was, so he didn't even think it would be something people would want to come and see him for. He was studying at Warrenstown College and got a phone call from his dad one night, and kind of finally just realized in that moment his dad was actually an old man, because his dad was quite old to be a father. So Sean went back to look after him for a while, and then that sort of led to him just learning more about the herbalism business and just carrying it on, just kind of happened, and his confidence grew with it. And then, yeah, he always had this secret wish inside him to kind of go down a spiritual road. And he looked at becoming like a priest or a monk. And that way of life is what he thought would kind of be for him. And he carried that for a large part of his young life. But it was kind of the herbalism, I'd say, brought him out of it, because he was treating someone up the north. After his mum passed away, he was treating someone up the north. And he was up and down over 100 times with this person who wasn't supposed to live. And one particular Sunday, they turned a corner, and they, you know, they were looking like they were on the road to recovery. And Sean stopped in a monastery on the way back from this trip. And whatever happened in there, he doesn't know, but he just realized that he needed God, but he needed God in the world, is how he puts it. So that kind of life of isolation, I suppose, as a monk, wasn't for him. He had more to contribute, maybe in the world itself. And that was it. And that was his mind made up. And then really quickly, I think within 6 months or something like that, or definitely within the year, he'd met Tina, his now wife. And that was a whole new life for him then. So yeah, he hadn't planned it at all.
Was there an element that all his dad had achieved in terms of, you know, the IRB background in terms, and I guess the role of a leader, basically, and the kind of herbal, the family business that had been passed down through generations? Was there an element of pressure, do you think, that you know, that he saw what his dad had achieved in various strands in life, and, you know, it's like, am I gonna reach those heights, I guess?
Yeah, I don't know if he felt pressure as such. I think he felt, I don't know if pressure is the right word, but I think he felt a kind of pressure to carry on the herbalism so as not to lose the heritage, not to lose the knowledge. I think there was a pressure there to not throw that all away. And then it would be lost forever because it's been passed down for so many generations. So I think there was that. But I think also his love for it grew and grew and grew. So I don't think it's something he carried as a burden for very long. I just think he didn't necessarily want to start off in that way, but that's where he ended up, if you know what I mean, rather than it being too intimidating to start.
The fact that I suppose he didn't kind of go down the road of religion, I guess, as his vocation or career. But it seemed like maybe the desire to go down that road, the kind of the spiritual nature, he definitely seems to bring that more than what you would think. I guess looking at a lot of sporting managers, like, you know, it seems more the arm around the shoulder type of management than, you know, absolutely laying into guys and roaring and bawling in the dressing room. Now, in fairness, they do say, I think Graham Geraghty puts it, you know, if you did something wrong, you were kind of brought down the edge of the field and it was pointed out to you. But it just seems it's a very, very different kind of a way that he went about it.
Yeah, for sure. Tommy Dowd told a story that's not in the film itself. We couldn't fit it in, but he told a nice story of how, I'm not sure what the match was, but Tommy Dowd, it was in Crow Park, and Tommy Dowd has scored a goal, I think. And he was doing some big celebration up at the hill to the Dubs, kind of like irritating them, kind of showing off. And that was fine. And then the next week of training, Sean just said in front of everyone, not naming Tommy, that he didn't want any showmen on the team. And that's all Tommy needed to be told, to say, you know, calm yourself down a bit and don't be so arrogant or whatever. And, you know, he made the point in a way without having to shout at anyone or without having to make anyone feel small. He just made the point. Tommy got it. They moved on. And he kind of had a nice way, I think, mostly of dealing with things.
Liam Hayes, at the very start of the documentary, he says a line, you know, you don't meet too many people in your life that have magic dust, and Sean has one of them. And I think we've kind of maybe explored, you know, why that was, but he also makes the point that he had two teams. And I was thinking there aren't too many GA managers have done that. I mean, like Jim Gavin has stepped down at the end of last year. He completed the 5 in a row with Dublin, but, you know, that kind of essentially, it changed a little bit over the time, but that essentially was one team. I mean, I think Cody is probably the only one I can think in the GA sense. So like the team of the 80s that wins it back-to-back All-Irelands and that contests a couple of All-Ireland finals. But then, you know, I think Colin O'Rourke had retired in 95. People wonder where Meath football was going. Amazing to think he lasted 10 more years after that, winning 2 All-Irelands and I guess reinventing the whole sense of Meath football.
Yeah, I think it's a huge achievement and kind of proves his greatness, I guess, because it wasn't necessarily just to do with the players, you know, because he did it twice. I think what's interesting for me as a filmmaker was Darren Fay, I think, says it, where he says, It was like the team of the 80s, Sean was like their big brother. The team of the 90s, he was like their father figure. So I just think it's really interesting to see his development as a person and as a manager over the time as well, and how he stepped kind of into I think the 90s is like him at his peak, and the greatness that he became like in 99. And we kind of in the film really celebrate that moment. I don't know if you remember, but he's holding the cup in, on the pitch in Crow Park. And like, it's just, I think that's him at his absolute peak. I think it's lovely to see that development over the two decades.
Yeah, as a Cork man, I don't know that I enjoyed the 99 footage just as much as you did when he denied them the double. But like that stuff about Faye is just like I remember him, you know, when I was growing up, like he was one of the absolute stars of football, and he's just not a guy that you hear too much from anymore. I mean, I was thinking during the documentary, like Colm O'Rourke, I suppose, is obviously a guy we see every week on the Sunday game, and he's in the Sunday Independent. But two guys from different eras that stood out for me were Faye and Brian Stafford. And the quotes I have at the end, like Brian Stafford says, he brought me out of my shell a lot more than I would have been able to. And Faye touches on that he said he didn't have much values growing up. And he's getting quite emotional, it seems, from the footage. I mean, there's obviously probably a lot of stuff that you weren't able to fit in, which maybe, as you'll probably be able to tell us, maybe demonstrates this as well. But it really just seems like, I mean, this wasn't a normal relationship between Darren Faye, you're the fullback at the edge of the square. Here's your tactics for the game. I'm the manager on the sideline. It like, as he says, like it is almost like a father-son relationship.
Yeah, no, it was so much more than just a football manager relationship. And yeah, Darren Faye kind of credits Sean for instilling values in him that he's carried on into his life in everything else he's gone to achieve outside of football. And even to the point of like being able to have a family and children of his own and be that kind of person himself. He kind of puts a large credit to Sean for that, which is incredible, really, when you think, when in theory, all Sean was a football manager.
How were the players in terms of kind of getting them on board for this? Because, you know, it'd be lovely to think that every All-Ireland winning manager has this sort of a bond with his players, but it's just really not the way. I mean, the great book that Dennis Walsh wrote about hurling the revolution years, there's a line that always stuck out at me about Ollie Baker talking about Gerlach Nann, and that was a very successful and kind of iconic team. And I think it's along the lines of, you know, he was our leader, but, you know, I wouldn't say he was our friend. We weren't close, but that's the kind of way it had to be. And maybe that was a different set of circumstances worked for that Clare team. But like in terms of getting the players on board, like how receptive were they when you contacted them first of all and said, right, I'm making a documentary about Sean Boylan. Do you want to come and join me and sit in the dressing room and recall old tales?
Yeah, I wasn't sure what way it would be before I started. I was like, oh, are they going to be up for it or are they not? Is it going to be a hard sell? And I was very lucky that they were all very up for it, which I think has nothing to do with my charm or persuasion. I think they all feel a responsibility almost to honour Sean, I guess, and talk about him. Like, I know Mick Lyons, he's in the film, and I think Mick must have said to me about 45 times, if you want anyone else now, get someone else. Like, if you want to cut me out, cut me out. Like, he really, I think, would rather not be in it. But he just feels a responsibility and I think a great sense of gratitude to Sean. So he wants to, if he's asked, to share his story of Sean. And I think there's Brian Stafford particularly as well. I think he definitely would rather not be on camera. But he just did it for Sean.
Yeah, so it sounds like it was an easier sell. Like if you had said to them, I'm making a documentary about Meath football for RTE, maybe some of them would have run a mile. Because even like in the McLean stuff, he a good few times he's kind of looking to Jerry McEntee. It's like almost as if, well, you take the lead here now, you do the talking.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I had to, because I interviewed Jerry and Mick together and I had to keep kind of making Mick answer the question as well, because Mick would happily let Jerry talk away. But yeah, they were keen to do it for Sean. I think you're right. If it was just a general documentary or it was just about me, I don't think they would have appeared in it. I think it's Sean means so much to them, they feel they need to share the story.
Like, you list his honours as Meath manager afterwards. I mean, Meath's, I thought it was interesting when you look at them and frame them in terms of what Meath have done overall in their football history. I mean, they've won 7 All-Irelands, he's been manager for 4 of them. And I'm wondering, in a way, I suppose you were looking at his character, but has his greatness been magnified by what's happened since? I mean, this is Dublin's football world and the rest of us just living it. I suppose that's the national sense now, but it's definitely been the sense in Leinster for a long time. And it's coming on 15 years this month since he stepped away as Meath manager. And I mean, you, like, you touch on the 91 game, you know, the four games in 91 and that saga at the heart of the Meath Dublin relationship, but it's also different now.
Yeah, no, it is. It's funny, actually, this didn't make the film either, but we went up to a Meath match in Croke Park last year and filmed just members of the public, Meath fans, just getting little sound bites from them about Sean. And there's just still a huge respect for Sean. A lot of people said, bring Sean back. There's a lot of this. There's still a great love for him. And I think people still really, not embrace, but they still really very fondly remember those times when Meath were on a high. And I think they'd love for them to come back. And Sean's obviously a huge part of that.
Was there a lot of that? I mean, I presume it's the same for a lot of documentary makers, you know, trying to figure out what to put in, or a lot, like, you know, but was there a lot of kind of stuff you were like, God, it'd be great if we could put that in, but we only have 55 minutes?
Oh yeah, that's the whole problem. And that's what I was saying about Sean. Fantastic, but he's almost too layered, and there's almost too many sides to him to try and put in a documentary. We've got 52 minutes to play with, and it's 4 13-minute sections. Like, that's all you have. And they go by so quick. There's loads of things we'd love to put in. There's loads of other maybe smaller angles to Sean, or other relationships Sean has with interesting people that we just can't fit in into the overall narrative, if that makes sense. But yeah, just so much to draw on, which is great in one way, and then also a struggle in another.
Yeah, I can imagine that sounds almost a bit of a nightmare, a headache for you to try and get your mind around. I mean, I think I'd only come across this a few years ago, his friendship with Tony Wilson, two, you know, very opposed characters, you would think, you know, but quite amazing how close they became.
Yeah, for sure. That's a fascinating one. Like, Sean's one of his son's godfather. Yeah, he's the godfather to one of his sons. Very interesting relationship, but there's so many others as well. Like, Sonny O'Sullivan was heavily involved in getting the buoyancy aids that the Meath team used to train in Gormanstown in the water. There's just all these random connections to people that are really interesting, but are just so hard to fit in. But it's a good problem to have.
Given the times we're living in, how did everything that has happened with the world kind of going into lockdown in March, how did that affect the actual process? I mean, like, when would you have kind of wrapped up the filming, and how has this all been kind of delayed, this whole project, because of everything that's been going on over the last few months?
We were very lucky to have finished filming just before things got too bad or we went into lockdown. So that was great for us, because if we hadn't have got the last filming days done, we probably wouldn't be airing the film. We wouldn't be airing the film now. So yeah, we edited then during lockdown, which was fine because you can do it remotely. So I was spending a lot of time on split screen with my editor in London trying to edit the film, which isn't ideal, but it does work. And what was really lucky is our colorist who colored the film probably wouldn't have been, he's very experienced. He probably wouldn't have been available, but because he was furloughed from the other project he was working on, he could work on it. So in some ways it actually worked out well for us. But it's made everything, it's all very strange, but we're just lucky to have had the filming finished.
So you're in the kind of final countdown now. How is Sean himself feeling? Have you been in touch with him as regards before it airs on Thursday night?
Yeah, I saw him last week and I might be seeing him tomorrow, I think. But I think he's excited. I think he's a little bit apprehensive as well, because, I mean, it's exciting and apprehensive for me, but for him, it's his life and it's his story, and it's very a personal thing. And he's very open in the film, which, you know, I'm sure for him is kind of a little bit daunting, but I think people will love him all the more for it, really.
Yeah, I mean, that openness, just kind of, I suppose, before we finish, I mean, he talks about his health, problems, and, you know, in 2009, I mean, his wife Tina's talking about, you know, her fear and kind of how scared she was kind of around then, and then later his children are basically talking about, you know, the open kind of warm guy that you hear about in a dressing room or on the sideline. That's exactly the kind of dad that they have known all their lives. You know, it's kind of a nice way for it to finish.
Yeah, that's it. I think I wanted to, from the outset with the film, you know, obviously there's the huge story of the Meath football in there, but I really wanted to get to the heart of Sean as a person and who he is. And I think that, yeah, part four kind of focuses in more on that, into his personal side and kind of get into the crux of him as a person.
So the documentary is Sean, The Life and Times of Sean Boylan. It airs on Thursday the 6th of August on RTE1. Alan, thanks a million for joining us today. So that was Alan Bradley, the director and producer of Sean. The documentary airs on RTE1 tomorrow night and is well worth checking out. Thanks a million to Alan for his time and contribution this week on Warriors. And thank you to you, the 42 members, for your support as always to us. We really do appreciate it. Thanks also to our producer, Kevin Brannigan, for putting this together. You can get in touch with us in the usual ways if you have a suggestion for a future episode or a topic or a player or a team that you'd like to see us cover. Email sport@the42.ie or tweet us at FOTool13 or at Warriors_GAA. We'll be back next week with another great guest. Until then, take care.
To the British Army, once we crossed the border, we had no power. I think we've a bit of power now.
Our mission was to show that we're no longer the whipping boys of Munster.